Cut.
Hello, 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 and welcome to episode 15 of The Ink Drop. I'm your host, Matthew McGevna. I am really excited to share this episode and the guest I had on this week, Anthony Manza. Anthony works with the National Student Debt Forgiveness Center, and this organization helps out a lot of people who are really just swimming in student debt. This is a topic that is near to me. Years ago, I might never admit this, or at least I'd never admit it publicly, but when I went to college, first of all, when I chose my college, I had some criteria that I needed to check off. So most people who know me know this, that I knew, since I was in the fifth grade, that I wanted to be a writer, a novelist, a poet, a screenwriter. I wanted to write books that would get turned into movies, the whole nine. So when I got into a position to shop around for colleges, I had to do 2 years of community college first because my grades in high school weren't the best. But when it came time for me to transfer, I wanted to transfer to a four-year college that had a really strong creative writing and English department. That was one criteria for me. And another criteria is that I wanted something that was close to home so I could commute back and forth to college. I knew myself well enough at that time, even then, to know that if I went away somewhere and lived in the dorm, I would never go to class. I'd be wandering around the nearby city. I'd be partying. I'd be socializing. I'd never go to class. So I wanted to stay close to home to avoid those distractions. So when it came time to choose a college, I ended up going with Long Island University, Southampton College. It's on the east end of Long Island, out in the Hamptons. Actually, in some ways, I was kind of wooed there. A lot of big-name writers, you know, I wanted to be a writer, and there were a lot of big-name writers who lived out there. Kurt Vonnegut, George Plimpton, Joseph Heller, Norman Mailer, Peter Matheson was there. You get the point. They're all gone now, but they were there when I was transferring. So I was attracted to that school. I was looking for some mentorship. I was hoping maybe some of them would be kicking around the university, maybe doing some guest workshopping and whatnot. when I was attracted to the school, and that's where I ended up going. Now, it's a private school. And at the time that I attended, it cost around $16,000 a year. And my scholarships covered maybe $5,000 a year. So I needed to borrow, just for tuition, I needed to borrow about $11,000 a year. And another thing that I believe most writers can attest to, this is the other aspect of this, most writers can back me up on this, especially young writers, is that the one commodity that all writers need is time. Time to write, time to read, time to revise, time to think. And here's where it gets a little embarrassing in hindsight. I made it a point in my planning for transfer to work as little as possible, right? To try to actually to hold a job, a part-time job, summer jobs, like work a little bit in the summer, save up money, odd jobs here and there, weekends, enough just to pay for gas, food, maybe a night out at the bar, but not much more than that. I wanted to have my day hours free to write my books, to read, to revise, to walk around and think about what I was going to do with my next chapter. And I say it's embarrassing because I know a lot of people who worked full-time while they went to college at the same time. I know a lot of people who, you know, barely had time to eat because they were running from their job straight to class and then back to do homework and then up at 7 o'clock the next day to go to work. And so they were working full-time and going to school full-time. I didn't do that. I was 19 years old. I told myself, you know, you can't be tied down with some entry-level job just sucking away your time to write. So what did I do? I needed money for car repairs, maintenance. I needed money for clothes, for food, for textbooks. So I borrowed it. I borrowed above and beyond the $11,000 that I needed to cover my tuition in order to cover those other expenses. My second embarrassing admission is that I really thought I was going to graduate at 22, 23 with the great American novel in my hand. It was going to sell at auction, you know, for six figures. I'd make another seven figures off the rights for the film adaptation. I had it all planned out. I was going to win the Pulitzer and the National Book Award. You know, I'd be hoisted on the shoulders of people in the streets, carrying me down the sidewalk. When I walked into rooms, people would just applaud. So I didn't think about the fact that I was borrowing $50,000-$60,000 because I'd be able to pay that off with the, you know, with the extra change I had in my wallet, you know, because I was going to make so much money off my writing. So that didn't happen, obviously. And over the years, I incurred more student debt when I went back to get a second master's in education so I could do what a lot of writers do. I went into teaching. And now here I am, and I'm happily employed, New York City public school teacher. I really enjoy my job. It's challenging, and it's enriching, and I get to talk about literature sometimes. It's the best. You know, I really like what I'm doing. But it took a long time to get there. And I have this debt, which has really ballooned beyond control. You know, at this point, it is the second highest debt that I have, next to only my mortgage. And it is the equivalent of what some people in America may be paying as their mortgage, what I owe in student debt. I'm not alone in this situation, and the statistics clearly back that up. There is, we are approaching $2 trillion in national debt, student loan debt. There are 44 million students who are in debt, according to Forbes magazine, who are in federal student debt. 44 million students are in debt. There's been a lot of talk lately about this idea of debt forgiveness. Since Joe Biden won the presidency, you know, there's been a lot of online chatter. It's really grown exponentially over this issue. Biden is talking about, in some cases, full debt forgiveness. In other cases, talking about up to $50,000 worth of debt forgiveness for students who went to state college. Now, that's state college. That doesn't help me, but I'm sure it helps a lot of people because I didn't go to state college. I went to private school. So I've got a close eye on the situation, not only because I'm personally vested in it, but because I do think that it is really creating almost an odd kind of underclass. And I even think in some ways it's contributing to the mental health of a lot of people in this country. You know, as I said, 44 million people. I've got a close eye on the situation. You know, I got a close eye on watching what's happening, what's being said or online and whatnot. And as can be expected, the issue has turned political. For example, the conservative commentator Ben Shapiro tweeted about Biden's plans to forgive debt. He wrote in his tweet, quote, "Those who paid their bills should be outraged. Those who never went to college, now subsidizing the degrees of those who went to Wesleyan to major in social justice, should be outraged. This is a subsidy to the aristocracy. It's the reverse of progressivism," end quote. So I'm the aristocracy? Someone should quick tell my principal that. You know, and it also, that kind of attitude is pervasive. He's not the only one who's been spreading that around. You know, like, oh, you majored in women's studies. So sorry, you went to Sarah Lawrence and majored in underwater basket weaving. You're going to have to pay your own debts. I'm not paying for that, right? So it's become a very popular thing, at least online, for people to really react angrily to the idea of student debt forgiveness. And it really grossly mischaracterizes what people get into debt to study. You know, we're not all graduates from upper-class private schools, because a lot of people talking about like Yale and Columbia, and you know, but not all of us went to these Ivy League upper-crust schools, right? And we're not all standing here with obscure degrees that can't be used in the public or private industry, in some industry. I know there are writers out there right now, maybe listening to this podcast, who are also public school teachers, postal workers, police officers, public transportation workers. And our student debt has gotten beyond really any realistic chance of paying back before we retire from our jobs. Right? So we're talking about 30-year loans that students will take out at 24 or 25, let's say. They get into this loan when they realize just how difficult it is for them to make standard, you know, interest and principal payments, standard loan payments. They usually negotiate something with their lender, and they get themselves into a 30-year debt, And when you calculate, you know, at 25 plus 30 makes them 55. Yeah, they'll be paying off their college graduation, their student debt loans, right around the time that they're going to retire from their jobs, if they're lucky. And they don't actually still have to make student debt payments with their fixed income retirement checks or their pensions. So I know that there are writers that are out there that are in this situation. So I'm really excited to bring you this guest because Anthony is an expert in the government's student loan industry, which it really is an industry. He's an expert in the student loan forgiveness programs that are out there. And I hope this conversation helps some of you who may not know about the programs and the options that are out there for you to get some relief. So here is my conversation with Anthony Manza of the National Student Debt Forgiveness Center.
Like a Hellcat.
One. Anthony Manza, how are you doing?
I'm doing well, Matthew. Thank you for having me.
Oh, no problem. I wanted to talk to you. I reached out to you a couple weeks ago because I this is a really important conversation I think to have. The people who listen to this podcast probably are, a lot of them are in my situation where they're writers, and you know, they went into college thinking about how they were going to be able to use their English degrees or their creative writing degrees, maybe generate some money through their books. And a lot of times that doesn't really work out that way, but meanwhile they've accrued a lot of debt. So what ends up happening is that, and I can speak for myself, I'm one of these people who borrowed a lot of money thinking, you know, I would pay it off as my career went along. And then, you know, you realize when you get into the business end of writing and you realize just, you know, the money isn't quite there when you get out. And the next thing you know, you sort of, you're digging yourself deeper and deeper into debt as the interest accrues. And I think that happens, that's happened to a lot of people. And I know ever since Biden got elected, there's been some conversation about student loan and student loan forgiveness. If you can, for a second, lend your expertise, like set the table, how would you characterize the student loan crisis or the student loan situation in America?
Well, it's funny because doing what I do, I come from a completely different field. And I worked in the service industry for 30 years. Same with the same organization, and I started at the bottom as a busser, and eventually became a partner. And throughout my time there, as you can imagine, Matthew, a lot of people that work in restaurants are kids who are trying to put themselves through school. And we would see, I started to notice the cycle of people, you know, our teenage, you know, kids working for us staying longer and longer. So whereas we'd lose a girl or a guy to go to college at 18, then all of a sudden they were staying to 21. Now all of a sudden they're staying to 25, you know, and then finally they're out with, you know, 2 degrees and they're still working, you know, on the weekends, maybe one night a week to supplement their income. Long story short, what you used to get by with an associate's became a bachelor's, which became a master's, which became a master's plus, all for the same amount of income. So I think what it comes down to is you have people working later in life. They're not retiring. You know, we can get into a separate conversation about that, but people are having to go to more and more school to basically attain jobs that are entry-level positions. And a lot of them need to take out student loans to do it. And unfortunately, I don't think a lot of people realize that, and this is my opinion, but student loan debt is, to me, after the real estate market and the stock market, it's sort of a source of income for the government because the crisis is now closing in on $2 trillion. The government realized this roughly 15 years ago when they started to get more heavily involved in student loan debt. And frankly, I don't think it's going away anytime soon.
Yeah. You mentioned the debt that we're, I mean, just some statistics that I found on Forbes, like $1.6 trillion so far in student loan debt in the country, 44 million students in debt. Are actually on, you know, took out federal loans. The average debt is around $30,000.
That's the average. But then the average salary coming out of college is around 51,000 gross. So figure after taxes around 35,000. So 30,000 in debt, about $35,000 a year after taxes. 4.5% interest is the average, which is higher than home mortgages. So there seems to be, like you're saying, incredible imbalance where you're almost spinning wheels, no?
I mean, you are. And frankly, the way federal student loan debt is set to matriculate, if you will, the lenders are trying to have people pay back double what you borrow. And it's very easy to do so. So, you know, that $30,000 that you have in debt, and you mentioned a great point about, you know, $35,000. I think that's even, you know, slightly aggressive, probably closer to $30,000 in income. You know, it's very easy to turn a $30,000 debt into $60,000. The lenders sort of push you into what we call loan mismanagement. That's, to me, is anything that takes 10 years, more than 10 years to pay back. The thing about student loans, Matthew, is this. First off, it is the second largest debt that most people ever pay back past a mortgage. If you don't ever have a mortgage in your life, it's most likely to be your largest debt that you ever pay back. Mm-hmm. The thing about student loan debt, to me, is it's a sunk cost. Let me explain. If you list your priorities of bills that you need to pay, right? We all know at some point the ends have to meet. You're going to worry about your housing first, right? Because if you don't pay it, they can evict you or, you know, foreclose on your house. Mm-hmm. If you don't pay your car payment or your transportation, they take away your car. You can't get to work. We all know that everybody has communication bills, right? We need to feed ourselves. At the end of the day, student loan repayment usually falls at the back end because they can't take your education away. You have it, right?
Right.
So they always will give you alternatives to make lower payments so that the bill is paid, but the interest is accruing and accruing and accruing.
Yeah, I mean, I could say for my own case, when I was trying to do, you know, because I'm one of those, got out of college. I had a bachelor's degree in English. I went into journalism, but I was freelance for a number of years, so it was not a full-time salary position. In the meantime, my debt is accruing. I went back and got my master's degree in creative writing. You know, and part of this is also, to some degree, I mean, I have to accept some responsibility for it. I think in my head, I thought that, you know, I would sell my first novel for a gazillion dollars and I wouldn't have to worry about it. So I went and I borrowed money that would also afford me a little bit of time to work a little bit less so I can work on my degree and focus on my studies. But the point I'm making is that as I started to drop down to sort of minimum payments, I realized as I'm looking at my total bill, the number wasn't going down. It was going up every month. And I was making these payments out of pocket. But what I was making wasn't even paying down the interest. And that seems to be happening with a lot of people. No?
Well, the thing about student loan repayment and where my organization sort of comes into play and what we do is there are two different methods of loan repayment. Okay. And for a lot of people out there, this is a surprise. Especially older folks who, you know, grow up knowing only about principal and interest-based repayment. You know, principal and interest-based repayment rewards higher monthly payments, but frankly, a lot of us can't afford that, right? So, and the lenders know this and they want this. The problem is that they don't give you an option to explore the other method, which is called income-driven. You have to request it in order to get it, and they don't give you any help navigating it because ultimately the lenders want you in the standardized, which is principal and interest-based repayment. They want you in the standardized programs. That's what they put you in when you get out of college, and ultimately it's geared to have the lower monthly payment but a longer repayment and a more costly overall repayment.
Yeah, that's what I noticed. It's either $800-$900 a month to try to chew down the principal and interest, or it's $150 a month. But when you're done with the life of the loan, you probably pay double what you actually borrowed. In a lot of cases, Why did the government get involved? Do you know, like, the history? Why did the government get involved in lending students money anyway? Was it just...
Well, they were always involved, as far as I know. But what they used to do was, banks used to lend money. Okay, so we have private banks, like, for you folks out there who have Discover or Wells Fargo or Sallie Mae is the biggest one. They issue private loans, and the government, there's banks that issue federal loans as well. At least there used to be, like I said, in the late 90s and early 2000s, and the government used to back the loans, meaning that if you went into default, you know, the government sort of, you know, bailed out the bank or paid it off. What wound up happening was, like we said a couple of minutes ago, the government realized that there was a lot of money to be made in student loans. You know, again, the debt is $1.6 trillion, and that's depending on where you read. It's growing every day. Mm-hmm. So ultimately, instead of allowing banks to, you know, collect this money, they basically started, you know, paying it out themselves. The way the lenders or the servicers, however, whichever word you want to use, and for the folks out there, we're talking about Navient, Nelnet, Great Lakes, Mohila, if you heard of any of these names, what they do is they're charged with collecting the government's money and then collecting a portion of the interest. So through these alternative programs that are offered for folks, you know, a lot of people, if it's done correctly and timing plays a part in it, you can potentially pay back the loan without even paying back your complete balance, which means that the lenders don't even recoup a dollar of money because it's all paid back to the government and the rest of it is forgiven, which I'm sure we'll get into in a few minutes. Yep. But ultimately, Matthew, the government realized there's a lot of money to be made. And there is no answer to the crisis, I believe, because even if you made, say, city or state universities free to in-house, in-state collegians, there's always going to be the Dukes, the Princetons, the, you know, Harvards, the Stanford of the world that are going to put your son or daughter in a better position to get employed with the same sort of... I guess, you know, GPA and resume, if you will, and they're always going to charge money.
Right, right. And the, it's funny you mentioned some of those lenders, but those lenders sometimes they get sent to you. Like, as a lender, you just get assigned to them. I didn't shop for Nelnet. I was getting my mail from Direct Loans, and then one day I started getting mail from Nelnet. It seemed like they just kind of, what did they
Correct.
Do? They sell you, explain that. How does that happen? Because you're supposed to be able to shop for things, I would think. But
so, well, the thing with student loan payment is no lender is better than the next. So the numbers are all the same. Mm-hmm. So it's, I always tell some of my clients, it's not like leasing a car where you can go to one dealership and get one rate and then go to another dealership and get another rate. It's based off of simple math. The problem is that the lenders don't alert people of all of the options. You know, and when you think about, I would say 8 to 10% of borrowers are in default right now. Okay. And another probably close to 5% are facing it. And when you're not alerted of all your options, that sort of plays into the problem. The name of the lender that you wind up with, you know, they're basically all, they're all the same. I know Navient gets a bad rap for some of you folks in there that know about student loan repayment, but that's just because they're the biggest one. You know, so they have the most files, so therefore they're going to, you know, ultimately catch the lion's share of the criticism. And they are misleading, you know, but ultimately all of the federal lenders, Matthew, they're all out for, you know, they're all out to make money. It's, you know, a lot of people denigrate them, and you can, you know, choose however you want to feel about it. But at the end of the day, they're in business to make money. They're not the government. They're contracted organizations. Like most things in life, they you know, revolve on profits.
So maybe this is a little too into the weeds, but do you know what the system is? Like, how did Navient get the most files? Like, do they divide them evenly? That's just contracted out with the government?
I don't know exactly how files get assigned, but I can tell you that Navient is sort of a subsidiary of Sallie Mae. So we all know Sallie Mae, they were the biggest one. And Sallie Mae used to do federal and private, loans. Now they deal strictly with private, and they created Navient to handle all their federal loans. Wow. So it's probably just a, you know, it's probably, I don't want to say a layover is probably not the proper word, but, you know, Sallie Mae passed down all their federal, you know, cases to Navient, and then along with the other loans that Navient gets from the government.
Yeah. So I got to tell you, Anthony, I consider myself one of the lucky ones because I was brought to your organization from my union. So after all the years kicking around in the private sector, I ended up becoming a New York City school teacher about 5 years ago. So I'm in my sixth year. And through my union, the UFT, United Federation of Teachers, they brought a workshop to my attention from your organization, and I've been with you guys since. Can you tell us a little about your organization, what the name of it is and what you guys do?
Sure. So we're the National Student Debt Forgiveness Center. Okay. We're a third party advisory group. The best way I liken to our organization is we're sort of like accountants for your student loans. Problem is, a lot of folks don't realize that it can be beneficial to have somebody managing your loans that know all the options. So what we do as an organization, and we're educational first, we alert people of different forgiveness programs that they may be open to. So part of the reason why we attempted to partner with the UFT and have, you know, a nice exclusive relationship with them going on 3 years now is because every single member that is full-time of the UFT is eligible for a forgiveness program that we know the lenders aren't alerting the borrowers about. So what we do is we take a look at the loans, and you know, every loan, Matthew, has a range of outcomes financially, a low end to a high end. And be quite honest with you, depending on how you mismanage your loans, the high end can be infinite, right? But ultimately what we try to do is we try to drop a pin, if you will, on one of the lower ends to where you can limit what you're going to pay back to the lender. And the beautiful part of the forgiveness programs a lot of times is it doesn't necessarily raise your monthly payment. A lot of times it actually lowers it. Hmm.
So it was nice to, I don't know, like it's hard to explain this sort of emotional reaction I had, but when I sat through, there was like a 1 or 2 hour webinar before I pursued it and signed on with your organization that you guys put up on like a Zoom call. And it was just nice to hear somebody who was kind of on your side, on our side, you know, and giving us a full range of information that we weren't really be given by our lenders. And I was on the call with about 600 other teachers, and we're all listening to it was a lot of information, but the sum of it was that there were all these options and programs that were out there that are available. And then, you know, some amazing success stories. So it was really kind of nice just to hear somebody who you could actually trust that was going to give you the straight deal. Because sometimes you would call, like my experience with Nelnet has been sort of up and down. Like I would call and sometimes I would really get somebody on the other line who would be straightforward with me. But then, you know, sometimes they have a tendency to pull some shenanigans. It's just nice to have somebody sort of in your corner. And I think that's what your organization lends itself to, you know, like just being an advocate in some ways.
Yeah, I was going to say, we know exactly what the lenders know. We just use it for the borrower instead of the lender. That's exactly what it comes down to.
So what I signed on for was something called the PSLF, or the Public Service Loan Forgiveness Program. Could you explain what that is, the PSL? And the reason why I'm asking you is because I have my audience are primarily writers and people who are pursuing writing. And because very often it's very difficult to actually make a living off of writing, very often they go into teaching and they become public servants like I did. So that's why I wanted to have you on and ask you about the Public Service Loan Forgiveness. Can you talk about that?
Sure. So to explain public service loan forgiveness best, I have to sort of, you know, illustrate the alternative method of loan repayment, which is income-driven repayment. So income-driven repayment is an alternative method, like I mentioned. There are only two methods in which you can pay back loans, principal and interest-based and income-driven. The income-driven program has two real good benefits to it, okay? So the first benefit is the loan payment is not attached to the loan balance. So whether you have $20,000 in loans or $60,000 in loans or $200,000, your loan payment is derived from completely different criteria. So that makes it an advantageous program, especially for borrowers who have large balances. The second part of it is all income-driven programs have ultimate caps on them, meaning you only need to make a certain number of payments and then you have satisfied the loan financially, okay? So most loan repayment programs for standard are usually 25 to 30 years if it's over $30,000, okay? Income-driven programs can cap out at 25 max, but usually cap out at 20 years of repayment. Now, right there, you lost 5 years of loan repayment. And it's not about squeezing the payments into lesser monthly, lesser term payments. They're based off different criteria. Public sector loan forgiveness essentially is if you are a full-time city, state, county, government, town, or military or not-for-profit employee, if you're full-time, or if you work two part-time jobs in that sector totaling 30 hours, then that term of 240, let's say, can drop down to 120. So the less payments that you make, obviously the less money you're spending. The government will forgive the balance tax-free for public sector employees. Okay, for non-public sector employees, if you reach a 240 or 300, depending on your loans and the program you pick, but a majority of it being 240, if you reach that number and there's still a balance on your loans, they will forgive the balance with taxable income, meaning you get a 1099. But long story short, what I tell my clients that fall into this category, would you rather pay $20,000 or the taxes on $20,000? You know, option B is obviously great. But when it comes to public sector employees, you know, it's the payments are based off of income and your household size and how you file your taxes and what you, proof of income you choose to submit. So a lot of times, again, especially for folks that have, you know, if we go on the average $30,000, this can be a hugely beneficial program to sort of pay off your loans, pay it off at a rate you can afford as opposed to one that's dictated to you by the lenders. And most importantly, not mismanage that loan. Get it out, you know, at a time where, you know, you can enjoy the second half, the two-thirds portion of your life without the loans sort of hanging over you, if it makes sense.
Yeah. So in terms of who qualifies, that public servant, so you could be, it could be a postal worker, it could be teacher, it could be municipal, like a sanitation workers, things that if they have college debt.
Sure. Most hospital employees qualify, not-for-profit organizations qualify, you know, children's services, you know, again, anybody, most people in education, you know, they're really, you know, they really, you know, governmental employees. So I have, we do work with Homeland Security, those type of people qualify. Again, the not-for-profit sectors, you know, for all the folks out there who, you know, who do early intervention, a lot of those people qualify. So, you know, it's a pretty wide-ranging group.
Yeah. And the way it was sort of explained to me was, is that it's not, I think one of the first things that had to get sort of beat out of my head was that it's not about the monthly dollar amount. You think about your monthly payments that you make, not as dollar payments, but as credits. Each month that you pay is like a coin, right? It's like it's a coin of the realm, basically, just that you made a monthly payment. Is that, did I make? Am I characterizing that correctly?
You're spot on, Matthew. Some of the hardest thing that I have to do for some people is convince them that this is not a program based off of principal and interest. And I understand why it's difficult, because that's how we were all raised to, you know, to think about loans, right? Yeah. But, you know, depending on your file, essentially in this program, a $100 payment and a $300 payment essentially count the same thing. They count as one payment, or like you said, one credit. The whole goal is to get to 120. And then if you're a public sector entity or not-for-profit, they will forgive that balance tax-free.
Mm-hmm. So how do people get the ball rolling on the program? If somebody's listening to this and they're interested, what would they need? How could they I mean, obviously I think it would be great to reach out to you guys, but what are the steps?
So, you know, a lot of times, I'll come across a file, and this happens, you know, for you folks listening out there, you know, once a day, once every 2 days, where somebody has $100,000 in forgiveness. And I tell them this and, you know, they're flabbergasted. They don't believe it's real. You know, it is a real program. It's part of why the UFT sort of sought us out and partnered with us. It is a federal program. It works. Now, you're going to hear, if you do research, you're going to see a lot of people have failed in getting the forgiveness. All right, Matthew, you know, the first 10-year block of people that were eligible, the percentage of people who achieved the forgiveness were less than 1%. Well, okay. So long story short, guys out there, there's a lot of parameters that have to be in place, right, in order to qualify. Matthew, you and I went over this when we initially spoke. It's not as simple, guys, as being a public servant and making loan payments. You know, the government will give the forgiveness, but they're going to make you jump through the hoops. Mm-hmm. So, you know, you have to have a what's called a direct loan. Okay, it's a loan type. You have to do income-driven repayment. That's non-negotiable. Mm-hmm. So think of all the people that are doing standardized payments. You know, all your payments aren't qualifying. Mm-hmm. You have to make these payments on time and in full. So, you know, if they're late, like a standard program, principal and interest based, where if your payment, say, is $300 and you don't have it that month, but you have $250, you know, in that scenario, it pays to sort of give the lender the money. You're getting, you know, you're chipping away at that balance. But in the public sector program, if you're not on time and in full, you're not going to get, like you said, you're not going to get your credit. So everything's got to be on time and in full. You have to be with the correct lender, and you have to do specific paperwork yearly that qualifies where you're working. Remember, this is for, you know, public sector entities. There's something that the government's getting out of it by your service. So, you know, all those things put together, you know, equal, you know, a cycle. And as you have to do income-driven repayment, these things need to be recalculated on a yearly basis. It's a lot like your taxes. So the government's giving you payments based off of your income. They're no fools. They know your income's likely to change, right, Matthew? I mean, you know, just strictly for a UFT teacher, the salary between year one and year 10 is, you know, it could double. So the government wants their share of the pie. And if you don't recalculate, guys, the lenders are very quick to kick you out of these programs because they don't want you in them. So, you know, it's a lot of moving parts. You know, the whole thing with public sector loan forgiveness to do all this is you'd ideally want to have a consolidated loan. So I say ideally. Now, for all you guys out there, you want to consolidate your loans if it's beneficial. It's one of the things that the lenders don't do to people when they start loan repayment that they should do. You know, so if you're doing the public sector program especially, and if it's advisable, and that's where an organization like mine comes in, you know, we make sure that if we're advising a consolidation, it's an accurate advisement. There are certain scenarios where a consolidation could be harmful, but ideally you want to consolidate your loans, make sure you're with the correct lender, do your income-driven repayment, hopefully get the lowest possible payment, and then do your public sector employment paperwork. For everybody out there, the thing about income-driven repayment, and hopefully I've made it sound pretty enticing, is that it is a very subjective submission, meaning that how well you fill out the application determines how high or low the payment is, right? So, you know, if you fill it out, guys, it's not about an approval or a denial. It's about an efficient payment. or a less than efficient payment. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
So yeah. Obviously, if we know that they're going to forgive you after 120 payments, we want to obviously make sure that every one of those 120 are as low as governmentally permissible.
Yeah, it's interesting you mentioned about consolidation. Actually, in my particular case, consolidation wasn't the way to go, but that's why it's good to have somebody kind of look over what you have done, what you have, so that they can sort of take an inventory of what would be the best route for you. Because I remember reading a story in the Wall Street Journal that a person was under the impression that all their years in public service as teachers, I believe in the state of Maryland, was being applied towards their loans. And they come to find out that it wasn't, because it was like an unsubsidized, or it was, I believe it was an unsubsidized loans that they were paying. It weren't direct loans. And so all those years that they were working, thinking they were going to get forgiveness, and it wasn't counting towards anything. So it's good to have, it seems like it's good to have somebody out there who really knows all the different nuances so that you can check all the boxes.
Yeah, well, what we try to do is, you know, obviously there's parts of loan repayment that are apt to save you money, right? But again, a consolidation helps your credit score, okay? So most consolidations, after 6 months, you'll have a credit boost. Even when you think about these forgiveness programs, Matthew, you know, 10 years is, you know, the soonest you can get out. That's still a decent amount of time to have, let's say, 8 or 12 loans open on your loan balance, right? Mm-hmm. You know, you want to, if you can, consolidate your loans. Now, we're not talking about refinancing out there, people. You don't want to turn the federal loan into private. A lot of refinances are done through consolidation, so that's not what we mean here. Mm-hmm. We're referring to, you know, basically taking out one federal loan to pay off a multiple federal loan balance.
Yeah. And you are essentially giving the government a service that, you know, your labor is essentially the service. So, you know, I have some friends who are also in this program, and we kind of joke around that it's like an indentured servant program. You know, nobody likes to say indentured servitude anymore, but, you know, it is in the sense that you're working in the public service, and that it's a way for them. They're getting something out of you on that end. You're providing a service for the public good. And so, I think there's sometimes there's a stigma about people who are in this program that they're trying to get something for nothing, but I don't think that's the case.
Well, I mean, Matthew, you know what it comes down to? A lot of people, depending on what your income is and what your loan balance is, you may wind up paying a good balance of your loans, or maybe even a little bit more. But everybody has to remember that, you know, your loan isn't what you borrow. It's what you wind up paying back. Right. So the lenders are charging interest. You know, you mentioned subsidized and unsubsidized. What that basically mean is the unsubsidized portion of your loans are accruing interest the second you take them out. So, you know, the government wants to get a good portion of your money back, or more importantly, the lenders. So, you know, I mean, ultimately, we can sit here and argue about the merits of public service. I, for one, you know, think that teachers are, you know, they're underpaid. Hospital workers, especially nowadays, are underpaid. Mm-hmm. You know, what the government gets is, you know, for their forgiveness, if you will, they're getting 10 years of servitude, like you said. Mm-hmm. You know, public sector employees are less likely to commit crimes, more likely to vote, more likely to buy houses, which plays into the real estate market. Most teachers have pensions and TDAs, which again play into the stock market, which is, again, we mentioned before, another form of the government getting money. They pay all their taxes. So, I mean, you know, this is a one hand washes the other type situation. The problem is that most public servants who have student loans outside of the UFT are not aware this program exists.
Right. Right. And that's what I was hoping to do this for. The reason why I was hoping to do this is to raise awareness about it, because it really is a great weight off your back, knowing that there's light at the end of the tunnel, particularly for some of us who are, you know, up in the six figure, you know, category for loans. Can you tell me, speaking of some of those success stories, I know during the webinar we had, they mentioned, you know, there was some slides with some quotes and testimonials. Can you think of any of those success stories? You could share some of those.
Absolutely. So, you know, I'll use some loose examples, folks, because all of the numbers for your student loans in the income-driven programs come off of a governmental algorithm, okay? But let's just say we have a, we're going to say a social worker, okay? And she goes to, you know, she goes to school and she accumulates $100,000 in debt, which between undergrad and grad is, you know, Matthew, you could attest, pretty easy, right?
Yep.
And she comes out of school and she has $100,000 in debt. So let's talk about what the lenders do right off the bat. The lenders will issue you a 10-year standard payment, which is principal and interest. That's their default payment. So right off the bat, this social worker is faced with a payment of probably around, let's say, $1,150, $1,200 a month. Okay. Now, again, she has housing, car, phone, you know, and she's probably making, if she's lucky, $50,000, maybe, you know, if she works for the UFT, possibly if she works for a not-for-profit, maybe in the high 30s, 40. Now, even if you're making $100,000, a $1,000 a month payment is extremely difficult, right? Yeah. So what the lenders do is they don't offer a 15-year program or a 20-year program to see if that's more affordable. They put you right into a 30-year program. So long story short, guys, if she were able to afford the $1,150, $1,200 a month, she'd still probably wind up paying back, let's say, you know, $140,000, a little bit more, right? $144,000. Yeah. That's roughly still $40,000 on top of her loans, and she paid the loans off in 10 years. She struggled with extremely high payments for the majority of the time, couldn't live life. So what she's more likely to do is she's more likely to go into a 30-year term with a reduced payment. This payment will still probably be somewhere in the 500 to 600 range, mm-hmm. okay, which still may be more than she can afford, but a lot better than 1150. She could wrap her head around 550 a month. And what she winds up doing is sitting in that program with escalating rates, which is the most popular standardized program, guys. Again, standardized is principal and interest based. The most popular one is something called a graduated, which, you know, has gradually increasing rates every 2 years. They're all interest only in the beginning, and she'll wind up paying back probably about $250,000 on that. All right. Now, because she is a public sector or not-for-profit employee, and she came to our organization, we do an income-driven model, which is, again, based off of different criteria, not her loan balance, her household size, her income, her tax filing status. And let's say based off of $40,000 with a, you know, a family size of three, she's looking at a payment of maybe $170 a month. Okay? A lot more affordable, right? Mm-hmm. And if you insinuate that she's going to get gradual raises every single year, you know, and the payments will go up gradually as your income does, usually. It's not definitive, but they usually work like that. Just so you know, just for the people out there wondering, if your income actually goes down, the payment can go down too. It does work like that, but we all hope to make more money in life, right? So the social worker, you know, starts off at say $40,000 and she gradually increases, you know, maybe she pays back in total, you know, $40,000, let's say, on the $100,000 loan. All the while the loan's been accruing interest. And, you know, at this point it's, you know, after, you know, 10 years and very, very minimal payments, there's probably still somewhere in the neighborhood of $130,000 to $150,000 left on it. And the government will basically forgive the balance tax-free.
Wow. Yeah. Yeah. And there's a lot of those cases. I mean, it's incredibly stressful to have that kind of debt hanging over you. And there's no recourse, obviously, because bankruptcy on student loans is not an option. It's nope. Probably one of the only loans where bankruptcy is not an option. Not that bankruptcy is ever a good thing either, but it's a nuclear option that's not even on the table. And it's just incredibly stressful to have that over you. And I just remember that really resonated with me when I joined your organization, when I saw the PowerPoint slide and all the people just putting up, just when they put up a chart of how much they paid off. And you're right, it was around 40,000, but then, you know, having about 100,000 or so could forgiven, and they've got their lives back and they're still in their mid 30s, early 40s. And they're not thinking about, you know, I'm going to be done with my student loans when I'm 65. I'll be paying off my student loan right when I'm getting my pension from retirement. you know, that in and of itself seems like an incentive.
Yeah. Yep.
Now, what are some of the practices that lenders, you know, do to watch out for? Because one of the things that I encountered, I don't mind sharing this, is that, you know, I got, so I'm looking to get an extra certification for teaching, just to broaden my marketability. And so I'm getting a certification in TESOL. I'm in school for that. I'm paying that out of pocket. So I'm not lending money for it. I'm under a teacher program that, it's like a grant program that I'm part of. But because I'm in the program and I'm considered full-time because it's 6 credits at the master's level, I one thing that they started doing was they moved me out of the income-based repayment and they put me into like a student, what is it called? A
deferment.
An in-school deferment they gave me. And I didn't ask for it. My school notified, the bursar notified Nelnet that I was in school full-time. Maybe thought they were doing me a favor. I don't know. But all of a sudden I was bounced out of this program. And that is a big no-no with the Public Service Loan Forgiveness Program, right?
Yep. So, you know, you basically hit that nail on the head when it comes to one of the biggest things that, you know, the lenders do. And again, cycling back to what I was talking about needing to do more and more school, you know, to attain certain salary levels. Mm-hmm. You know, deferment seems great, guys. When you're in school, you don't have to make a loan payment, but everything the lenders do, everything is based on that accruing interest. So when you go into deferment, that interest is accruing. You know, when you're doing income-driven repayment, especially if you assume you're going to make more money as the years go on, you want to hit those payments at lower income rates. Because frankly, you know, most people get taxed, you know, after deductions and pension, you see half of your income, right? So it's really, really valuable to get those lower income payments in. And so if you even go to school and you pay for it out of pocket, there's a communication between your institution and your lender, your schooling, and they will put you in deferment without asking, like you said, because that interest accrues there. Most people are fine with it because most people are okay not making payments. Obviously, if you're in a forgiveness program, you know, this is something to look out for because you ultimately, you want to keep the ball rolling at lower incomes. Whatever you don't pay now in forgiveness programs has to be replaced at the back end at a much higher income, therefore costing you money.
Yeah. The deferment. Yeah. The in-school deferment puts a pause on the credits that you're supposed to be accruing, those 120 credits that you need to gather. Right? The deferment puts a pause on that, and that's one of the problems that you think, oh, great, I'm not making payments, but you're not collecting any credits either. You're literally in limbo. What I found especially galling about what they did with me was that right now everybody's in a sort of a deferment or forgiveness plan right now because of COVID. So here I was collecting credits during this COVID period, right? You know, the government has suspended that, but they were going to put me in school deferment, and it was like I didn't even need in school deferment because I'm not making payments anyway. So you're kicking me out of the program that I need to be in, you know. And now is a great time, I think, you know, because we're getting credits for payments that we're not making for the time being, you know.
That's a great point. Anybody who can get into the program now will essentially receive somewhere in the neighborhood of 5 free credits because student loan payment has been paused till October. One of the worst things that they do, Matthew, in regards to deferment is there are folks and clients of mine who go back to school or pay for school out of pocket, are in the forgiveness program, they get placed in deferment and are still making the payment thinking that it's going towards the credit. Meanwhile, it's going to the lender's pocket. That is the biggest, you know, thing that happens, which is a crying shame.
Wow.
You know, what you faced with the deferment and the federal forbearance, for the folks out there who are wondering what we're talking about, the government has paused payments for 85% of student loan borrowers from March of 2020 through October of 2021. But all of the people who are in the public sector program are having this time counted for them. You know, it's basically a silver lining in an extremely, extremely dark cloud, you know, due to the pandemic. But again, if they would have placed you in deferment, the same things occurring, right? You're not making a payment, but ultimately what they're doing is they're making money for themselves, because you're going to have to replace those months again down the road when you'd be achieving the same result of monetary non-payment, but it, having it go towards the 120 months.
Right, right. So it's, yeah, there's a lot of those little, like, you know, you got to almost really stay on top of your mail, open all of your letters. Sometimes it can get daunting. You get those letters bombarded with letters from Nelnet or Navient, and you might just leave them on your coffee table. But now I'm like a hawk. I open all my letters. I read everything all the way through. Sometimes I even say, I must annoy the hell out of you sending you pictures of them.
Nah, you annoy me so much that I agreed to do a podcast on a Friday night, right?
That's true. Yeah, but it's so what are you? Yeah, so but it's, you know, you really do. You got to stay on top of it, because they find different ways, and you know, in some ways it's I don't even know how sinister they're necessarily being, but it ends up hurting you in the long run. Like, you have to really be aware of what's going on with the program and what qualifies, what doesn't, and yeah, in school deferment would basically put a pause on you, so you don't want to do that. The other thing I was sort of, actually, oddly enough, a lender gave me this advice with the income-based repayment, was to try to, if you think about maybe possibility, if you can, to file, if you're married, is to file separately, because the income, your spouse's income, might get considered into the income-based repayment. Is that not true, or?
Yeah, no, it totally is. Income-driven repayment in general, guys, is, you know, it's not always the best way, but a lot of times it is. The problem with it is it is very tricky. There's a lot of different, you know, scenarios where if you don't do something, you know, correct, you're going to turn around, you're going to have a lot higher payment than you expected. And the thing about it is that once you figure out you want to do income driven, right off the bat, the lenders know that you've figured out something that's going to cost them money. So they're not going to basically give you the little nuances. I'm surprised that servicer rep actually recommended that, but
yeah, me too.
but you want to do a separate tax return if you're married. It's not mandatory,
right?
But it gives you the most options. What I tell my clients when we're talking about married joint versus married separate is that my goal is not to get people into the program. My goal is to get them through the program and out of the program. And doing a married separate return, you know, gives you, like I said, a lot of options. You know, the government does accept pay stubs as proof of income, but, you know, we always worry a little bit about whether or not they're always going to accept it. I think they will. I understand why they do. But at the end of the day, you know, the tax return, especially if it's a single file or a married separate, can produce a lot better numbers. I'll give a tip out there for all the UFT people that might be listening. One of the numbers that the government uses to determine your loan payment is your adjusted gross income, which is found on your 1040 form. You know, a lot of folks out there have TDAs. I don't know if you do, Matthew, but the more you pay into your TDA, the lower your adjusted gross income can be.
Right.
So there's a direct correlation there. So basically what it means is you're paying your pension or your retirement instead of paying your loan payment,
yeah.
Which is a really good, you know, a really good tip.
Yeah. And what are your thoughts about student debt, or the concept of student debt forgiveness, I should say? Like, I know it's becoming more and more, Biden talked quite a bit about it, and there seems to be a movement, at least online and social media. You see people talking about debt forgiveness, and it seems like there's really an interesting divide going on. People feel like, well, why should my taxes have to pay because somebody went to study, you know, underwater basket weaving, which is a real gross mischaracterization of what people who take out loans are. But, you know, what are your thoughts about student debt forgiveness as a concept?
Well, I think we could all agree that if you take out $40,000 in loans, which I think is where the average is trending, you shouldn't have to pay back $80,000, right? I mean, I think right off the bat, you know, that part is broken there. Mm-hmm. You know, I think if we all agreed that, you know, whatever your balance is, if you had to pay back, say, 10% on top of it, and that was going to be the rate, and it was over a certain amount of time, you know, maybe we could all get by. I know we can go all night in regards to this. And obviously, I'm objective because I work in student loan reduction. The fact of the matter is, and this comes down to probably something I said in the first couple of minutes, the lenders do not give you all your options. Okay. You know, you have to think of it as a taxpayer that if somebody's going to school, and I don't think any scenario is bulletproof, right? But, you know, you're going to school to better yourself, to be a productive member of our country, therefore make money and add taxes into the workflow, which ultimately you like to think that the more taxes we all give, the less we eventually have to give, right? It never really works out like that, but, you know, that's the dream. So, you know, I'm all for people educating themselves. You know, I think people need to be a little bit smarter about it. Mm-hmm. In regards to, you know, what kind of loans they're taking out. You want to have direction in what you do, right? But, you know, that's the trick about, you know, being, you know, living in America and going to school in the first place. We're forcing 18-year-old kids to make very serious situations and decisions, you know, based off of a lot of uncertainty. Yeah. You know, I think the government has already stopped started sort of limiting what borrowers can take as children and started putting it on the parents a lot. So if anybody's out there heard of Parent Plus loans, this is sort of, you know, the parents taking responsibility for the child's loan as opposed to the child doing it. You know, it's very easy to accumulate even $300,000 in student loan debt if you come from when I say educated on student loans and tuition background, and you just want to go to a good school to better yourself. A lot of these private schools out there are $75,000 a year, and you're looking at $300,000 in the blink of an eye, mm-hmm. and you don't even have a graduate degree yet. So, you know, that's a problem. I do think that as high school curriculum goes, maybe we could do a better job of educating children on, you know, what they're taking out, how it's going to affect their future, the merits of community college to maybe get that core based study and not build up too much debt, especially if you're looking to potentially go to graduate school. Nice. Those are just some thoughts. It's a hard subject to really drop your an opinion on.
Yeah, I know. You bring up a great point. You know, when you're 18, 19 years old, like what do you know? You know, you can never die and that you're going to make millions of dollars in your life. Right. All the things that you're sure of. And you know, I mean, there's a reason why parents or people don't want to give 18-year-old sports cars that do 120 miles an hour. But what is a loan, a bottomless loan, you know, but a fast sports car? It's like, okay, well, you know, I'll take this money out. Here's what I owe for tuition, but I'll take an extra 10 out so that I can get this car, or I can go, I can get this and that. And you know what I'm saying? Like it could very easily balloon because the mentality is that I don't have to pay it till years later. And by then I'll be making millions of dollars, you know? And I think you're right. I mean, your lips to God's ears as far as financial education at the high school level, because you're absolutely right. I mean, the amount of financial illiteracy that's out there, and I'm one of them. Me and my brother were the first generation in my family to go to college, and so you know, my mother didn't know anything about student loans and what the purpose was, what the process was, how it was going to all accrue. And you know, there's a lot of things about finances that I wasn't made aware of, and I certainly wasn't made aware of it in high school. It's been lacking for a long time, Anthony, you know, like that, financial, like, I don't know what you call it, financial literacy, I guess you would call it, right?
Yeah. Yeah. It's a good phrase. You know, I remember when I first started working, I'm going to tell a story here. I did a seminar at a library, obviously way back in pre-COVID days. And, I always remember a client of mine, I'm going to withhold her name, but she was from an impoverished neighborhood, and she went to LIU. For you folks out there who know LIU, it's a private institution, and she accrued the $300,000 in debt, and when you happen to do, you know, these library, workshops, at least, you know, for what we do, you get a lot of, elderly folk out there who want to get information for their children and their grandchildren. And I had a gentleman ask me, you know, what in the world was that girl thinking taking out $300,000? And I said to the gentleman, I said, sir, she came from a really bad neighborhood. She was told that a college degree would help her get out of that neighborhood. Mm-hmm. And she wanted to go away to school and get away from there as soon as she could. And she worried about the consequences later. I was like, and it happens so easily. Yeah. Thank God she stumbled upon us and we were able to do a lot of good for her. Mm-hmm. But unfortunately there are too many people who fall under the financial sword of student loan debt.
Yeah. So that brings me to, how do people get in touch with you? How do people, or your organization? You're in the New York area, so how can people reach out to you if they're listening to this?
Sure. So, my direct number for all the folks out there is 631-213-7521. Again, it's 631-213-7521. You can, call it, or even better so, text it and just, mention your name and mention Matthew's name. And we could set up a time to review your loans completely free. I will give you what I think is the ultimate strategy for you. A lot of this talk is really educational, but, until you get your own specific numbers and details, examined, it's really hard to know what you qualify for. But we can do that completely free of charge. And all my recommendations, you can take with you and try to implement on your own. We can always, put our action plan, if you will, into play for you to sort of guarantee the numbers that we discussed. We do have processing fees, but if you do go that route, but ultimately we guarantee our work, so nobody ever pays anything day of. We always have sort of a lack in payment to make sure that everything's approved. Like I said, at the end of the day, all it takes is 15, 20 minutes to sort of hear what a professional thinks is the best, course of action for your loans, educate them a little bit. If you choose to have us, implement what we discussed, that's completely up to you. But just know, guys, that a lot of the student loans or the lender's mentality is to, have misinformation out there, and lack of information is probably a better term. They want you to basically pay, your student loan debt and hope one day that the bill ends. A lot of folks don't know how much time they have left in their student loan, Matthew. Whereas, again, if you go back to that mortgage analogy, everybody who has a mortgage knows exactly how many years they have left on it, right? Mm-hmm. Student loans, I would say 90% of borrowers have no idea how much time they have left in their loans. So even to, get a simple education in regards to what's going on with your loans, again, I'd be happy to do it for all folks out there. Everybody who works for my organization does so because we want to help people. We always take the stance of education first.
Yeah, and I just want to also mention, since you mentioned time, you can also, the organization also can sort of look into your past and retro. If you have credits that qualify in the past years, they can apply that towards the credit count, correct?
Absolutely. That's probably one of the first things we look at. If there's a forgiveness program that you're eligible for, can we go back and grab older payments? Now, again, I don't want people to get overly excited in the fact that the government does a really good job of making it so that you don't, but right. That is the first thing that I look at and all of our consultants look at when we're examining a file, because what that's going to do, guys, is get you out of the loan sooner, which is ultimately going to save you the most money.
Yeah. So why did you get involved in this? Last question.
Well, like I mentioned, I was working in the service industry, and one of the the higher ups at my job, we got to talking, and he basically told me that once or twice a week he saved somebody $100,000 doing it. And for anybody who's worked in the service industry, I'm sure a handful of folks at least at one point or another did. you know, it's a lot of long nights and weekends and I wasn't seeing my family. But then, you know, to offer a position where you really, you know, get to help people save this type of money, it was intriguing. You know, I thought it was something that was probably a little exacerbated. But I could tell you guys now, you know, once every 2 days, I come across a file where I've saved that person $100,000 or more. It never gets old to come home to my wife and tell her, you know, babe, I saved somebody $100,000 today. Some stranger over the phone who I'll never meet, who will never meet me. You know, I make a difference in their lives. And it really is that true. I was glad it was brought to my attention. I'm glad I took the opportunity to learn how to do it. And then, you know, the partnership with the UFT, really, you know, is just the icing on the cake. The longer I do this, the more folks I reach, the more folks I touch. And I think in some way or another, I think we all want to make a positive, you know, impact on this life. And, this is my chance to do it.
Anthony Manza, thanks for taking the time to talk to me. I appreciate it. We did an hour, buddy.
Thank you for having me, Matt.
Thank you so much. All right, folks, that's it. Next week, I'm going to try to get somebody who is going to talk to me about disrupt techs, hopefully, if that's the case. Other than that, stay tuned, and I will see you all next week.